Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This episode, exploring our exotic country.
Sometimes I feel like we feel that there's two Americas. There's a lot of talk about divisiveness and left and right, red and blue and all that, but there's tens of thousands of Americas.
Writer Darryl Farmer talks about his work and discovering people community by community. I hope you'll join us. In the summer, I enjoy biking with family and friends, and some of those friends take pedaling pretty seriously. They will often bike 50 to 100 miles without thinking twice about it. Well, my guest today is writer Darryl Farmer. His book, Bicycling Beyond the Divide, recounts a 5,000-mile bike trek he made not once, but twice. It is a lyrical and engaging narrative that explores the American West as well as the author's emotional geography. It won the Barnes & Noble Discoverer Award. Farmer also teaches creative writing at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he's recently published a collection of short stories entitled Where We Land. The collection also displays Farmer's keen ear for dialogue, ability to conjure up intriguing characters, and deploy them in interesting stories. Farmer recently received an Alaska Literary Award and an artist residency to write in Iceland. I asked him to begin our discussion by reading from his first book, Bicycling Beyond the Divide.
Later that evening, after I'd rolled out my ground pad and sleeping bag and stored my bike in the little room with the concrete floor, I walked through Libby in the last remnants of the light of dusk. I thought back to that long-ago summer when Libby had been a vibrant town full of tourists and a summer sense of excitement. I'd camped in a city park where I met a man named Steve who told me about rock and roll rivers playing deep in the mountains. The campground had been nearly full, and I felt lucky to get one of the last sights. I was sitting at my picnic table when he walked over and sat at my table, not waiting for an invitation. He wore crooked black frame glasses and an old ragged t-shirt. His teeth were yellow, his curly brown hair uncombed. "I'm Steve," he said, sticking out his hand. I shook it. "I'm Darryl." He was from upstate New York, but now lived in Idaho. He spoke loudly and occasionally broke into raucous laughter for no apparent reason. "I usually don't camp in places like this. I like to go alone into the hills," he said. "What did you say your name was?" he asked. "Darryl," I said. "Sometimes I get a little spacey because of my past with drugs," he said. I could smell alcohol on his breath. "When I go hiking alone," he said, "I hear rock and roll in the creeks. I swear it, and I don't have acid on my head. But you have to go way back into the mountains, 30 to 50 miles from nowhere. Now, what was your name?" I repeated it again. "Some creeks play the meanest rock and roll. Sounds just like Jimi Hendrix." He said it as if hearing music in a creek was a profound religious experience, and who knows, maybe for him it was. "You have to be miles from nowhere," he repeated. "The hardest rock and roll you've ever seen." Again he asked my name, and when I told him again, he exclaimed, "Oh, just like Darryl Hall and John Odie." "Sarah Smile," I said. "You're a bitch, girl," he whooped, giving me a high five.
Darryl Farmer reading from Bicycling Beyond the Divide. Darryl, this book really encompasses 10,000 miles because it's two bicycle trips you made of 5,000 miles each, 20 years apart. Bicycling 5,000 miles is a pretty arduous task. When you were 20, why do that?
I picked up an article one time and it was about bicycle touring. You know, and something about that article just kind of clicked with me, that idea of leaving home and going on a journey. So that was something that I knew I really wanted to do. And at 20, you know, I don't think I had any idea what arduous was. You know, it's, you just get on your bicycle and go, you know. So, and then what you find out is once you're out there, all you can do is keep pedaling.
Well, on that trip, you kept a journal.
Yes.
And what was behind that?
You know, I just really wanted to remember the trip. I knew it was something that would be a profound experience for me, and I really wasn't thinking of myself as trying to be a writer at all so much as just remembering the day-to-day things that I experienced on that trip. So I started keeping a journal, and that began what's become a lifelong thing for me, keeping a daily journal, you know. Mm-hmm. And that started what later became a writing career.
Not long ago, you wrote, "To write of one's journey is to live it twice." And what does that mean?
You know, this is a large part of the writing experience, I think, especially relative to writing nonfiction. The lived experience, and then there's the writing about it. You know, and when I was writing this book, the act of writing itself was made so many of the memories come back to me, you know, more vivid things that I thought that I'd forgotten, you know, 20 years ago, all kind of were refreshed in my mind that way. So it was very, very much like reliving the experience through the page.
Well, you were obviously a writer when you undertook the second journey 20 years later. Was there a tension between the two journals, or what you noticed and what you jotted down?
Well, the original journals were very thin. You know, I wasn't thinking of being a writer, and I didn't really know what that meant. So a lot of them are kind of bare bones, what I did that day in the second. And there was maybe one journal that was kind of thin, you know, my day to day. The second trip, I had three kind of thicker journals that I filled up. I was much more conscious of writing down details and noticing things, and the idea of writing and trying to find the day-to-day dramas, because at that point, you know, I had the book contract going in, so it was a constant challenge of how can I make this interesting to a reader, you know.
You made an observation at one point about the relationship, at least emotionally, if not etymologically, between journal and journey. And I think of captain's logs. And there's a certain formal history to making sure there's some sort of record of progress in a journey.
Yeah.
Did any of that influence you when you were going to write this book?
Oh, very much so. As a matter of fact, one of my comprehensive exam lists, because I was in graduate school at the time that I wrote this, was on the journey narrative. You know, so I was reading a lot of things from Odysseus to Songlines by Bruce Chatwin to Blue Highways, which was a very influential book for me by William Least Heat Moon. So I was very, very aware of that idea of the journey narrative, you know, and the kind of day-to-day journal keeping that those kinds of works are involved with. So.
Were you always an outdoors person? Were you somebody who enjoyed being outdoors?
Oh, absolutely. And to this day, you know, my parents built a cabin about 30 miles from our house in Colorado Springs when I was growing up, on the flip side of Pikes Peak there in the mountains. And so my brother and sisters and I grew up kind of spending a lot of time outdoors. My brother went on to be a state forester in Colorado. So we're all very much influenced by the mountains there and being outdoors. So.
Now, was your family bookish? I mean, I'm always interested in what leads a person into the literary life.
I would say they were very bookish, but they weren't necessarily very literary. My father always had a book, you know, that he was reading, and it tended to be around the areas of business, biographies, history, and more kind of nonfiction books. And my mom also was a reader. As a matter of fact, she's always been very proud that she started reading to us almost from the crib, you know. So I did. I grew up in a house where books were important and constantly surrounded by them.
Mm. Well, now you got your undergraduate degree in physical education.
That's right.
Is that what you wanted to do? Did you want to be in that?
Well, that's what I did. I taught high school and I was a basketball coach for several years. I coached boys and girls basketball in Colorado and New Mexico. So I was a head basketball coach at a high school that had the oldest gym in the state of New Mexico, St. Catherine Indian School. So that feels like another life to me now, but that's what I did for several years.
There's something so straightforward and uncomplicated in a funny way about the body and exercise and games and participating on those levels. Does it strike you that way? And did you enjoy being a coach?
Oh, I enjoyed it very much. Yeah, yeah. And I always enjoyed sports when I was a kid, you know. So I spent hours upon hours in my driveway playing basketball, you know. But when I look at that now, a lot of my basketball playing in my driveway is a very solitary thing. And I think about it now, the basketball part of it was important, but it was also a lot of creating narratives in my head, you know, and they're the same narratives maybe every athlete has 3 seconds to go, your team down by one, that kind of thing. But it was also, I realize now that there's, that you can only do that narrative so many times before you have to start playing with it and mixing it up, and how can you make it more fresh and more interesting. So I don't think I realized it at the time, but the work I was doing on the driveway wasn't so much basketball as it was creating narratives in my head. You know?
This is Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. My guest today is the writer Daryl Farmer. As you'll hear, bicycling 5,000 miles allowed him the opportunity to explore the inner landscape, as well as the quickly changing towns of America's West.
So much of my life, and maybe our lives now, is juggling so many things that that feels like a really rare and precious opportunity to just spend time in your own mind like that on the road on a bicycle. So it was really pretty wonderful. I suppose there were times of boredom, but I don't remember it as being boring at all. I just remember that being just a really kind of healthy and mindful way of being on the road, you know.
Mm-hmm. It seems like whenever I'm traveling, my senses are heightened. I notice things a little more deeply. And for a writer like you, it must be extraordinarily that way.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the two things actually do the same thing. I think writing itself is an act that heightens your awareness, you know, especially nature writing or journalism, where you're kind of having to pay really close attention to the things that are happening around you. The writing does that. And then traveling, by its very nature, is something that takes us out of our usual comfort zone or our day-to-day life, and that in itself kind of heightens the awareness. So it seems to me that there's a long, long history of travel writing, and it seems like recording your experiences, and when you're outside your comfort zone like that, is a very natural kind of human instinct to do that. Mm. And the two do definitely go together.
When you're doing this kind of work, there's a certain amount of structure involved. I mean, a journey has a beginning, and mm-hmm. unless you're cut off in the middle,
right.
an end point. So there's a natural arc there. And it seems like for a writer like you, you were dealing and braiding two different arcs together. Did that seem like that was one of the challenges for you on that?
There was the arc from 20 years ago and the arc of the immediate journey, and I was braiding those things together. And I think maybe related, but I think it's the third arc is kind of, my interest is the American West, so it's somewhat, maybe this is somewhat limited, but the third arc was kind of looking at America and culture, you know, American society, American geography, immediately after 9/11. You know, and kind of just ruminating on where we are at this point in history. And that to me was a big part of the book as well.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, in your bio, it lists a not insignificant series of communities and places around the United States that you've lived. And so I'm wondering about that peripatetic life.
I get restless, I think. I've lived in 12 states, you know, and that's all been since I got married. I lived in Colorado till I got married, so that whole notion of settling down was kind of lost on my wife and I.
But, does she join you? Does she relish the these communities as well?
Yeah, she does, very much so.
That's
great. Maybe more so than I do. She's the kind of person that can just, you know, it's like quantum leap. She just drops into a community and fits right in right away, you know.
That's amazing. So. What do you find unique to communities, and what do you find in common?
Sometimes I feel like we feel that there's two Americas. You know, there's a lot of talk about divisiveness and left and right, red and blue and all that. But there's tens of thousands of Americas. You know, every community has its own ideas. Every community has kind of its own culture, and they're all very unique. And I think as a country, we live on the shallow edges of things when we don't recognize the many variances and nuances of what it is that makes such a a big and complex country like ours, you know. So that's one of the joys of a book like this, is just coming into a new community and realizing the feel of it. That's one of the joys of traveling. I mean, I grew up in America, but it remains to me one of the most exotic places in the world. And I think sometimes we don't always recognize that.
Well, let's turn to your short story collection, Where We Land. You wrote recently about why it's valuable for prose writers to study poetry. And it sounded to me like you were looking at the lyrical sentence. But I wonder, you have remarkable compression on some of these stories.
You.
And that's a device poets have to contend with, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I tell my students I think it's more important for the prose writers to study poetry than vice versa. And it's just that close engagement with language on a word-to-word level, you know.
Let's talk just a bit about some of the stories and the devices that I really was fascinated about. There's that wonderful selection you have between the daughter and the father, and you shift perspectives on that, and you do it so believably. Do you have any problem putting your head in another character's skull?
No, that's the story. It's called In the Long Shadow of a Winter Morning, and it goes back and forth between the father and daughter. I really enjoy that. I never studied drama and never worked on the stage, but I imagine that's what it's like for an actor to just kind of inhabit another character and get inside their head like that. And it's something I really enjoy doing. I don't have a hard time with that at all. I think it comes out of, you know, listening to other people and imagining what other people's lives are like, and just all of my travels and living in different places. I've encountered a lot of people, you know, and an important skill for me is just eavesdropping and learning how people talk, you know, and then when I go to the writing, trying to create a voice that's unique and sounds like only that character can sound, you know.
Another story that I found particularly affecting was Anniversary.
Uh-huh.
What was interesting in this piece is it's essentially, I don't want to say stream of consciousness, but it's really one long sentence.
Well, I had originally written that story a long time ago when I lived in Michigan, but it wasn't that way at all. It was traditional kind of, you know, many sentences like most stories would be, and it just didn't have the element I wanted. And I read a story. There's a story by Gabriel Garcia Marquez called "The Ghost of the Shipwreck," something to that effect. And it's one sentence. It's about six pages, and it creates kind of a ghostly, I think you're right, a stream of consciousness effect, you know. And those long sentences work really well for that, for dreamlike, for creating kind of a dreamlike quality, which is what I was going for in this story that has a little touch of magical realism, at least at the end of it. So I started experimenting with longer sentences, and then I thought, I wonder if I could make this into one sentence. And I tried it. It took a lot of revisions and work to get it so it didn't sound like just constant run, you know, so it didn't sound like the technique was overshadowing the story itself, which is always a concern in a kind of experimental story, but I worked on it. That story went through a lot of revisions.
Oh, I bet. On Denali Road, was I right in detecting a sort of a nod to Jack London's Build a Fire to Build a Fire?
Oh, absolutely. And even more so his story, which is a similar story. It's called Love of Life, which is another Jack London kind of surviving the winter story that was very influential on that.
Do you feel as a writer in some way obligated, if you're tackling a regional story, to at least acknowledge a predecessor?
Oh, I think we're always doing that. I think that we're always in, you know, writers are always in conversation with the work that's come before. I think that's maybe true in all art. You know, I think about jazz musicians that are, you know, you can hear the influence of Coltrane, you know, and maybe Marsalis's work or something like that, you know. But I talk to my students about this. I'll play them a Van Morrison song and say, listen to the influences. And, you know, clearly he's been influenced by his own Irish roots, but also American roots music and rhythm and blues and jazz and all of that. But when you listen to Van Morrison, you're only listening to Van Morrison. In other words, he has a voice and a style that's all his own, you know. And that's kind of how I think about your question, is that all of my reading and all my studies in literature are influencing my work, but ultimately it becomes its own thing and takes on its own life, hopefully.
You're listening to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. Today's guest is writer and professor Darrell Farmer. 2016 was something of a watershed for him. He saw his collection of short stories published. He won an Alaska Literary Award from the Alaska Arts and Culture Foundation. And as you'll hear, he was selected for an artist residency program in Iceland. Darrell, you recently won the 2016 Alaska Literary Award from the Alaska Arts and Culture Foundation. And it must be rewarding, literally, I guess, but there's a certain satisfaction, I would guess, in getting acknowledged like that.
Oh, absolutely. I think the validation of the work that comes with that is as important as the award itself, you know. So that was a very exciting phone call.
What does it mean for you as a writer? Does it give you possibilities that you might not have enjoyed otherwise? Or how do you see it influencing when you get one of these milestones?
I think the main thing for me is just a validation that it helps finance a project that I've been wanting to write, which is an important part of it, but it also suggests that the proposal for the project itself, you know, meant something to somebody and made it worth it. So it's just kind of encouragement to go ahead with that.
Now, you also won a fellowship to go to Iceland and write. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, it's an artist residency there.
What do you plan to do and why Iceland?
I have kind of a long obsession with Iceland. I started reading about it in various travel books, and something compelling about it. And then my wife and I traveled there a couple of years ago. And we were there for a short period of time. We rented a car and drove around the island. And I knew as we were driving that I'd spend more time there writing about it. So,
what was it about it that drew you, do you think?
I was surprised by the various landscapes. I knew it would be beautiful, but I didn't know how much the landscape would change and how different the geography is in different parts. There aren't a lot of trees in Iceland, you know, so I assumed it was just kind of all flat and ocean cliffs and that, but it was just the landscapes part of it. And just the historical, the sagas and the story of the sagas and the history of the country and, you know, its role as a place that we think of as kind of a peaceful place, I think, is a large part of that. And also Iceland is a place that very much embraces the arts. It's said that everybody in Iceland is an artist, and that's kind of what our experience there was. There's a lot of writers in Iceland. Very successful writers. The music scene's one of the most influential in the world for a small island that size. So all of those things are kind of enhanced my love for the place, and so I'm very anxious to go back.
Well, and what are you working on now?
I'm working on a couple things, as I tend to do. So I'm working on a novel that's set in Colorado, and I'm working on a nonfiction book that's also about America and American violence.
I always am a little bit in awe of novelists that they can keep characters and tensions in play for that long a period. Mm-hmm. Are you daunted at all, or how's that process work for you?
I think I'm going into it much like that 20-year-old on the bicycle, as I'm not thinking too much beyond the next 20 miles, you know, and that's the way I deal with it. But if I step back and think about the whole project, yeah, it's very daunting. But I like the challenge of it. You know, I like kind of having to, it's a different style and you have to think of it different than you would a short story. You know, because there's an immediate end, but there's a longer end to have to constantly keep in mind, you know. And then what I'm having to do is go back and start from the beginning over and over because things change as the novel evolves. And I kind of like that. It's kind of constantly recreating the story in my head, and it just seems like it's getting deeper and deeper and deeper the further I go. So it's a process I enjoy a lot, but it's time consuming. It takes longer than, you know, than I ever think it's going to.
How do you write? Often writers stay up until 2 a.m. and they're night owls. Others get up faithfully at the crack of dawn and write for 2 or 3 hours. How does that process work for you, Daryl?
I used to be that way. I used to write all night. I used to write late into the night. And then I was a morning writer for a while. And now my schedule is just such that I write when I can. I have a separate space, a writing space, a studio that I go to, and when I have time, I go there, and that's where all my writing happens. And that seems to work really well for me. I've had a lot of different processes. I see them all as tools, you know. I think if you buy too much into what you have to have at the moment, then if you don't have it, you think you can't write. My thing is to try to find time to write every day, and that's the work. If I work every day, then I'm doing it, and it doesn't matter what gets published or what gets finished. You know, if I'm writing every day, then things eventually, projects get complete. So,
well, this question of the journal, I'm often wonder. I know that some writers consciously use the journal to try out ideas or lift passages. Other times, they're really just a way to kind of limber up. It's sort of like doing some stretches before you go for a run or something. How does that work for you, the journal process?
That's the way it works for me, is it's just a way to limber up, you know, and keep track. But I also have another process, which is a free writing process, which I do to music. And I'll find myself, sometimes I'll do that around a specific project. So I'll just put headphones on and listen to music and just write. I have a musician that calls this doodling, which he does on his keyboard. And I have an artist friend, a painter, that calls it doing scales. So all three art forms are kind of on the same wavelength, but it's just creating, you know, without the constraints of a specific project or anything. And then what I find happening is I've done that for so many years that I have a lot of work that I can go back to and apply it to other projects and things. So,
well, Daryl Farmer, thank you so much for coming by and talking
with me. Thank you, Robert. This has been wonderful.
That's it for this episode of Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. My guest has been author Daryl Farmer. You can find out more about him and his books at northernsoundings.com. I'm your host, Robert Hammond. Thanks for joining us.